Stay tuned for The Lynn Show. Today, I'm airing an interview with Rob Ruggiero, who is currently directing his fourth production at the Oslo Repertory Theater in Sarasota, Florida. And yet again, he is directing the very first production of this season. This is a production of the musical South Pacific. I interviewed Rob for the first time last year when he was here directing Showboat, and I'm going to re-air a portion of that interview because it is the one in which he talks about how he became the artist that he is. And then I'm going to continue with the interview I did with him recently in which he talks about the current production of South Pacific. Rob's story is interesting. He is charming, funny, dedicated, passionate. So hang on. Here come the show.
Hearing from an inner voice, finding choice where there's no choice, with gentle prodding from the voice. Oh, you really can. Deeper, deeper down
Show. The Lynn Show is about being the person you really are. That is, not the person you think you should be, not the person you're pretending to be, not the person they told you you should be, not the person other people are, not the person that you believe is the one who's going to bring you attention, affection, love, comfort, safety. So many of us are demonstrating a way of being that's not actually the truth of who we are because something happened in our childhood that told us that something about us was not okay, was not what fit with the rest, was not what was expected. And once we got the idea that this thing about us was not going to bring us affection, attention, love, security, but was going to bring us criticism, maybe ostracism, maybe even punishment, we set about to try and pretend that this was not so. We weren't that. And children are so flexible that so many of us figured out ways to bury whatever that was. And we did it so well that we promptly forgot that we ever had that, that we ever were that, that we ever wanted that. Well, that works pretty well in childhood. That is what we do to protect ourselves. That is being self-defensive. But when you grow up, that doesn't work quite so well. Because we all know, unconsciously anyway, if we have buried something about ourselves, that there is something about us that's hidden, and we think of it as flawed, as bad, and that feeling informs everything that we do. It makes everything that we do more difficult. So, the Lynn Show is about making this point, asking anyone who's listening to ask themselves, was there something that I wanted to do? Was there a behavior that I had that I got criticized for or teased about? Or are there still stories about, you know, what I was like as a child that I don't do anymore? Are there qualities that I had to sacrifice that I could use today? So that's what the Lynn Show is about. And I interview people who make their living or their life with an art, because when you listen to them, you can hear what it sounds like to be who you really are, what we therapists call being congruent. And oh yes, if this is the first time you're listening, I am a psychotherapist, and it is in my experience as a psychotherapist that I have seen how many people are living limited versions of themselves. So, as I said in the run-up, today's interview is with Rob Ruggiero, who is a theater director currently here in Sarasota directing South Pacific, the opening show of the 2015 season at the Oslo Repertory Theater. I have interviewed Rob twice, so as I said in the run-up, I'm playing a portion of the first interview I did with him where he talks about how he became who he is, and a little bit about the South Pacific production. And then I will go on to play the next interview that I just did with him, where he talks about South Pacific. After I play the interviews, I am also playing a song from South Pacific, one that Rob and I talk about in our interview. Rob is very much worth listening to. And of course, if you live anywhere near Sarasota, it is worth coming down to see any production of his, including this one, South Pacific, which will be opening on November 14th.
Here is the talented, the interesting, the sensitive Rob Ruggiero.
Okay, I am here with Rob Ruggiero in an office at the Oslo. And I am here with Rob because he is directing the very first show of the Oslo Repertory Theater season. So before we talk about the show, and I do want to talk about the show, I interview people who make their living or their life with an art. And it's very clear that you... Are you laughing?
I'm laughing because I do make my living.
And your life.
And my life.
Yes, mm-hmm. With the art of directing. Mm-hmm. And I only ask one question, and it is, can you remember, can you recall, could you tell me, what was the very first moment in your life when plays, stories, directing, moving people around, having an audience, any of that struck you, occurred to you, happened to you?
I think... If you go that into the root of that question, there are two defining moments, mm-hmm. I would say. One is when I did a couple of shows. I was in the chorus, like, in elementary school. But, you know, I was, like, you know, kind of going with the flow. The most significant route I have is when I was in high school, and they needed a dancer for Oklahoma. Uh-huh. And I was Dream Curly, actually twice in my life. But... That I was, you know, kind of finding my way and finding my identity. So the earlier experiences, you know, weren't as meaningful, but I'm going to back up in a minute to when I was like 8 or 9. But the really the first kind of light bulb moment, I was actually a disco exhibition dancer. Not many people know that. And so that the person who was choreographing that, you know, said, we need somebody. They needed somebody to dance Will Parker's solo and be in the ensemble. They needed a dancer for Oklahoma. And it's interesting because I remember how life-changing that was for me. I found a place. I found my people. And if you know what that means, it's like I was always like a kid who related more to adults. I never found my group. I had a very, it's going to sound pathetic, but I mean this in a good way. I had a kind of sad childhood in that I didn't know where I fit. And then when I did that show, I found my family. Mm-hmm. I found my family. And all of a sudden, it turned my life around. I had this group of kids that I hung with. I found 3 people who were also in the show who were like became my BFFs. and you know, one of them has passed away, but 2 of them are still very close to me. Mm-hmm. And I found my show business family, and I found my niche. And I, you know, it's interesting, and I didn't know what part of theater, but I knew that theater was it. And, you know, I actually went to, you know, my family was like, but yeah, but you have to have a real job. And I went to college.
Oh, wait, back. You were going to talk about when you were 8 years old.
I'm going to get there.
Oh, okay.
I'm going to get there because it has to do with my first directing class.
Uh-huh.
And so, you know, I was a healthcare administration major at one point. And, you know, but in undergrad, I got involved in the theater department and as an actor. And I was actually, because it was a small liberal arts college, and I was doing a lot of lead roles, mm-hmm. actually. It was the actor. And, you know, and I started to kind of catalog things, and I started to begin to realize, well, I thought I was, you know, a decent actor, but I wasn't a great actor. I could sing, but I wasn't a great singer. I did a lot of fine art. I wasn't a great artist.
You could dance.
Wasn't a great dancer. So I was kind of jack of all trades, master of none. And then my senior year, another senior year moment, because Oklahoma was senior in high school, my senior year in college, I took a directing class.
Oh, dear.
And it fit like a glove. All of a sudden, I was like, this is what I am. I'm a director because I could use all those skills and that I was kind of not amazing at and put them all together into something that I could feel I was potentially really good at. All of a sudden, I thought back when I was 8 years old, and I would get my cousins together, and I would make up skits. I never didn't remember this, and I was little. I would get them together, you know, and I would costume them, and I would make up the stories, and I would rehearse them, and then we'd show them for the rest of the family. Because I had a very big Italian family, so we'd all be together, and we'd do it, and we'd perform. And I was like, oh my God.
You were always the director.
I was the director.
Right, you were always the director.
I didn't think about this. So those were the 2 light bulb moments. And even still after that, you know, my parents, now they're really supportive, but they trying to protect me. We're like, but you can't make a living as a director. So I have an undergraduate degree from Stonehill College outside Boston. And it was a self-directed study that was kind of a combination of theater and psychology and sociology and interpersonal communication. I had a long title. And then I, you know, I applied for grad school. I didn't get in right away because I was young. I was
grad school in what?
Directing.
Ah.
I was too young. I was still early in the theater. So I was actually, I had a picture framing business. I framed art and in a little art gallery, and I started my own theater, my own like community theater.
Yet again.
Yeah, you know, it was like it kept going a calling, and then 6 years passed.
Wow.
6, and I applied again to grad school, and I got in, and I have a master's in directing from Rutgers University, and you know, and I had a successful business at that time, so I. I thought, if I don't take this chance, if I don't give theater a chance, I will live my life always wondering what if. And since then, I have a master's in directing from Rutgers in New Jersey. Since then, I have never done anything else but work in the theater. Isn't that amazing?
It's amazing. It's a wonderful story.
Isn't it? Yeah. Actually, I'm 52, and when I was 49, about 2-3 years ago, my undergrad, Stonehill, gave me an honorary doctorate. I knew I was old then, so I have an honorary doctorate. But the point being, I have defined for myself a real life in the theater. And actually, when I was 39, turning 40, actually, 39, turning 40 was, the roughest year. And I was kind of struggling, I was working in the theater, but putting, utilities on credit cards and all that. I'm like, I can't do this anymore. I'm giving and giving and giving, and I'm not making it. And I decided to I explored something else for a few months. I did a production of the Laramie Project, and it told me that there was nothing else I could do. So I just decided that it was, and everything changed for me in terms of my success. And one of the things I'd love to say, which is kind of defined me, is as a young director, I did a lot of musicals. I did plays and musicals, but a lot of musicals. In my graduate work, I focused only on plays, and for a while, I was the guy who did the plays. And at a certain point I've been a director now, let's see, well, for 30 years, but 22 years professionally. And the last decade, I think, I evolved to a place where I'm one of the few directors in the country that do plays and musicals, both. And not many directors do both.
Mm-mm.
And here I am. So.
And here you are. It's a number of things are really interesting to me about this. You apparently don't remember what it was that motivated that 8-year-old. But that did not come out of nowhere. That was, so you don't remember seeing movies or plays or having said a poem and everybody applauded or, do you know what I mean?
No. I mean, I always like to, I said I was kind of an old soul, I will say that. I always related much better to adults than kids. I remember, like, silly things, like sitting in high school and, in homeroom and thinking, why are these people so immature? And so I think that some people have old souls, some people have new souls.
Well, do you have siblings?
I have an older sister, 3
so
and a half
years. So you're the baby
boy? I'm the baby.
Yes. A baby boy in an Italian family? That must have been a very prized position.
Prized position. But I think I've always, it wasn't that I was an avid reader or anything like that, but I loved stories.
Yes.
And I think that...
Did they read to you?
Parents,
how you know that you loved stories?
No, I just by watching TV and movies, and I liked going to the theater, but my family wasn't one that went to the theater a lot. I went with school.
Yeah. No, it doesn't sound like your family.
No.
No, this you came, you're one of those...
I kind of popped out.
Right, who didn't...
Yeah,
didn't
like it isn't like my family was in the theater or did... It was none of those kind of, I like to say, but it's not that.
No.
I just found my way. It was like a calling.
I hear this. This is not
unusual.
Yeah, it's not I don't know what to say. I don't want to say that it's common because I don't think it is common, but I don't think it's you're a one-off. I don't think it's rare. And you describe a number of things that I've heard. The sense of finding your place in the theater community, of being home, of finding your family, of knowing that you belong there.
It's so interesting, and I really, this is a moment I'm having right now, because the thing that defines this production of Showboat, and the thing that connected me into this particular piece of art, a piece of musical theater history, was the family, show business family, and I never, to this moment, made the connection.
It's funny, because I heard you talk about this earlier, and I was going to say exactly
wow.
that.
Wow. Yeah. I really haven't. It's like a little light bulb moment now, because that's the thing that moves me about Showboat, and that's the thing that inspired my whole vision for Showboat was the definition of family and show business family, because, you know, people out there who are not in theater who work in show business don't understand that we create these families quickly.
Yes.
Like, we show up at the first day of rehearsal and we're immediately intimate and immediately a family, and it lasts for has an expiration date, and then the show's over and everybody goes their own ways, and there are certain people that you hold on to, that those relationships endure, mm-hmm. multiple productions and multiple years, sometimes
a lifetime,
multiple
a career.
Decades,
right. mm-hmm.
And some people you're close with and have an amazing experience with, and you never see them again.
Yes, you know, forgive me, maybe this isn't accurate, but, and this just occurred to me, that good theater, good acting, maybe even good directing, demands a level of transparency, a level of vulnerability,
mm-hmm.
that inevitably leads to intimacy. And that's what makes for intimacy. And that, if you do it, if you give yourself, right, then the connections that you make based on that are really what family is.
It's so interesting that you say that, because I have a handful of teachers who helped, you know, extract my artist and pull me out.
Great.
But, you know, one of them said, I remember, it was an amazing man, said, you know, a great director is as exposed as a great actor.
Mm-hmm.
And people think you can't hide, you know, and the fact, like, I don't know, like, if you're more intellectual as a person, as a person, then if you're a director, your work is more intellectual.
Mm-hmm.
But my work, I mean, I love to make this joke, I don't think I'm as smart as some of the other directors, but I have a lot, I'm emotional, I have a lot of heart. I connect emotionally to a piece. And I think that's what
and
shows.
And you show that.
I think that's
you
what
don't,
shows.
You demonstrate that.
I do, and I think I have a gift of putting together family. We did, you know, doing a bunch of interviews, and I'm always, I don't know why, but I'm always surprised to hear the cast talk so emotionally, gratefully about me.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
And because I just do what I do, and they're like, I don't think about, like, I'm going to create a safe environment.
No, but
going to create a family, because I just need to do that in order to create.
No, I think you
it's
need
really
to do that.
Wild.
I think you need to do that. I think you've needed to do that certainly since you were 8. It just took you a while to figure out how to do it in the world.
Maybe you're right.
You know.
So, you know, this production has a lot of meaning for me, because it's allowed me to articulate that story.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, really, now that I'm in this moment with you, kind of unconsciously, I mean, like, express that, my own history of that story into this piece
into
of art.
Into this piece, absolutely. So you see, listening to Rob, that what you get is a deeply thoughtful, reflective human being who is bringing all of who he is to his work. And of course, what this means is not only will the cast feel that, be bonded not only to him but to each other, but the work itself is richer because he is exposed, because he is transparent. So whenever you see a piece of work by Rob, this would be Showboat, and now South Pacific, you know that what you're getting is an original vision which is created by a person who is deeply connected to the material, deeply serious about making it something that touches the audience. And if Showboat is any example, South Pacific will have the same impact. And so now I'm going to play the interview that I just did with Rob, in which he talks about the production of South Pacific. So I'm here with Rob Ruggiero yet again. And Rob is directing his fourth?
My fourth production for the Oslo. Yes. My, I was going to say second musical, but actually my third musical. Ella's kind of a musical play, but
yes.
But this is my first kickoff, my second kickoff of the season.
That's
big
right.
Musical. Last year I did Showboat, which we had a lovely conversation about.
Yes, we did. So today, really what I want you to talk about is South Pacific.
Wonderful. This is my third South Pacific in the last year and a half. I had done South Pacific at the Muni, which is 11,000 seats, outdoor amphitheater. And it was a, you know, huge cast and a huge orchestra. And it, from start to finish, it was about 10 days.
What?
I know, yes. And then I did the Showboat here. And then I did a South Pacific at the Paper Mill Playhouse. And that was a slightly longer rehearsal process, maybe a couple of weeks. But that production, which was really lovely, I knew the show from working on it at the Muni. Mm-hmm. And that was kind of a study for the direction we're going here. I'm such a process-oriented man, mm-hmm, and a process-oriented director. So in a way, it was like a first date at the Muni.
Yes,
you know, I got
yes,
to
yes.
know the show, got to know each other. I was able to do another level of work at Paper Mill, and that was a fun exploration. And then this production is like the one that I've been working towards and dreamed about when I first thought about the show before, because it's a new South Pacific. It's very intimate. Most of the other casts were over 30 people in the cast. This has 17 adults and two children. It's 19 people. That's significantly smaller for South Pacific. It's a brand new orchestration that Brad Hawk is doing. Brad Hawk music directed the other two South Pacific. So he did these new orchestrations that were commissioned by the Oslo, that were, you know, signed off by the Rudyard Hammerstein estate and organization. William Waldrop, who just got off the tour of Evita, is the music director. So it's a great team, and it's a great cast here. And I've always thought South Pacific would be really lovely to explore as a chamber musical, because in essence, most of the scenes are very small, mm-hmm, and there aren't a lot of big production numbers. I mean, the only big number that people think about is Nothing Like a Dame, which usually, you know, has a lot of men, and we're doing a version of that with seven. And it really is great. It's really great. I don't feel it's lost a thing. In fact, it's what it's gained is that these seven guys are more connected. So I made the joke at the beginning, it's kind of like more like Officer Crumkey. I have to say, now that we've rehearsed it, and these seven guys have amazing voices, and their energy and their sound and the number does not feel any smaller to
well,
me.
Well, let me say that I saw it at the meet and greet, right?
Oh, right, the press.
They did it right, and it was amazing there with nothing, you know, just
right.
These guys. Maybe this is what you're actually saying, but each of the guys' personalities then jumps out at you.
Yes. This is an ensemble. There's no being that third guy from the left or second woman from the right. They all adopted names, and some of them play more than one character, but they are equally present with the principals, and they need that specificity and what it's creating. For example, I've never really been fully satisfied with Watch That Man, because it always felt like Nelly and a bunch of girls.
Mm-hmm.
And now here it for the first time feels like four close friends. Do you know? And these little surprises have been happening. It's like the show is under a magnifying glass, which is for a show like this is a wonderful thing. I mean, it's brilliantly structured. It's a great story. This is a couple of wonderful love stories. It has humor. It's very moving. It's entertaining. It's provocative in the way that it addresses race and intolerance. And it's all slightly magnified. because the Oslo stage, although the theater is both big and intimate at the same time. It has, you know, it has a orchestra, a mezzanine, and a balcony, but it's all kind of pushed close. Mm-hmm. And the theater itself has a lot of height, but it doesn't have a lot of width and it has depth, so it's all kind of pushed in. And it's thrilling to see how the show's living there, and I'm very excited to move to the theater from the rehearsal hall, and I'm very excited to see the show, like, on stage.
Yeah, I keep thinking, and I think you said it, so I'm probably just...
reiterating.
Yeah, right. But the thing that kept coming up for me when you were talking about this is that because there are fewer players, and because you are so interested in specificity, right?
Yeah. And relationship and character.
Exactly. That, and you could even see it on the lawn at the Selby with these guys, that they each have a character.
Mm-hmm.
They each have a person. And so, you, for me personally, that's much more compelling than a bunch of people who don't mean anything.
Right.
You come to care for each one of these people individually because you know them because you have given them a character.
Right.
Yeah, it's wonderful.
And you can look around the stage at any time when they're in some of these bigger numbers and there's very specific life happening. And that's, you know, when you have great actors and you set that up, it's wonderful. Because I feel like the audience is going to probably more than often than not be looking at the primary action, mm-hmm. one hopes. But if you were to look around, and I do sometimes, but even if you don't, and you don't know what it is, but it feels like there's life on stage. It doesn't feel like a number. It doesn't feel like a show. You know, is not someone in the corner, like, talking about what they're going to have for dinner that night. They're all invested in what the world of this play is and the world of that scene is and the circumstances of that scene, or at least scene. At least that's what we try to do.
Yeah, you know, I love this idea. I just love it. I think that musicals quite often cheat themselves out of the ability to do that.
To me, a musical is a musical play. As we talked about last time, I'm one of the directors who do plays and musicals. And I think my work on plays, you know, helps me be a better director of musical, and my work on musicals helps me be a better director of plays. Because when a good musical works, whether it be a song that's sung or a piece of movement or dance, that story is always moving forward. The relationship is always moving forward. The ones that don't work for me is when it feels like, okay, well, here's the scene, and now we're going to stop and do a number.
Yeah.
Or we're going to stop and do a song. Or, you know, I feel something, and I'm going to stop and sing about it. Oklahoma, it's known for being that musical that said, we're going to not stop the story for dance or songs. I'm engaged by story and by relationship.
Yeah.
And what was groundbreaking for me, because, you know, I'm a big R&H fan. I'm doing...
You have to say what R&H is.
Rodgers and Hammerstein fan. I have a great connection to Ted Chapin, who's the president of Rodgers and Hammerstein. I have a friendship with Alice Hammerstein, who is Oscar Hammerstein's daughter. You know, I have this little private objective now. Four of the five of the major R&Hs. There's five. And so I've done King and I. I've done Carousel. I've done South Pacific now three times. I'm about to do Oklahoma. And so I just need to find someone to let me do Sound of Music. You know, like a lot of people, when I was younger, I thought, oh, Rodgers and Hammerstein pieces are lovely and they're classic pieces. When I saw a recording of the Hugh Jackman revival of Oklahoma, which he did in London, I thought that they had rewritten the book, and they didn't. Well, light bulb went off. If you just approach them like a play, and you look at them like, well, what is their relationship? What are the characters? What do they want? And you treat them with the integrity that they deserve. Great, really surprises happen. And I know now that this is years and I've done a number of them. Oscar is an amazing writer, Oscar Hammerstein, and way ahead of his time. I mean,
and courageous.
Courageous. I mean, they wanted him to cut You've Got to Be Carefully Taught originally, and he just wouldn't do it. And he was in a place, they were at a place in their careers that they could say, it's in or the whole show's not happening, you know? It's really amazing. And Michael Edwards and I were looking at the run-through the other day, and he said to me, looking at that last scene, he's like, seeing Emile Debeck, a French planter, you know, Nellie Forbush, a nurse from Arkansas, and two biracial kids sitting at the table, who would have thought that that was provocative back then, that that was saying this is the future of the American family. And it is now. There are American families like that, that we've got, we made some headway, which is really nice.
And I really think that is what art is.
Well, I think we have a responsibility as artists, looking at Showboat and South Pacific, and I know that somewhere there's a production of Hairspray being done. All three musicals deal with race and intolerance in different periods in our history. And we have to keep revisiting these because, sadly, when you look at these and you're reminded of these, you're also reminded that these issues are not erased. What I find particularly moving about South Pacific is that issue of facing their own intolerances, their own prejudice, happens to two very appealing characters. One, the most appealing, Nellie Forbush, who is sweet, a cockeyed optimist woman from, you know, Arkansas, who loves life and loves people and even like loves the kids when she sees them, but ultimately when faced with being in love with a man who had loved a woman of another color, can't seem to get past that, at least initially. And then you have Lieutenant Joseph Cable, Princeton educated, you know, a war hero in the making, you know, someone who you think would have very liberal sensibilities. And when he falls in love with Leah, a Tonkinese woman, he just can't wrap his mind around bringing her home. And what I think is fascinating about South Pacific is the one character you think will ultimately overcome it never really gets the chance to. And the other you think would never overcome it does. And even thinking that her love is dead, it decides to take on the kids. It's very moving. It's very moving and very progressive. You remember the circumstances take place in 1943, but it was premiered in 1949. And, you know, still on the heels of people's connection to war is very vivid. So you can imagine what their response would be to a piece like this. There are a lot of World War II veterans who are here in Sarasota. I'm very excited for them to experience the show. You know, one I've met a couple times, and he told me he was at the original production, like the opening of the original production. This is really fun. So, you know, I feel like there'll be a critical eye cast for the world, but hopefully the life of the show will touch and entertain and move them. So.
At the press thing, this guy got up and said, you know, I lived through this, and none of you lived through this.
How do you connect with it? Well, it's interesting, and, you know, very provocative and valid question, but that is the challenge of the artist. We can't be Joan of Arc. You have to be able to portray people of all types and all times. So there are correlations that you make, but that's what an artist's challenge is to find a way to connect with this world, this time, and live it to the best of our abilities. And remember, there's stories. We are storytellers. So we're trying to make this story live to the best of our capabilities. No one's ever, you know, saying that they are Nellie Forbush. It's an actor playing Nellie Forbush who lived in that time period.
Well, but the other thing that occurs to me is nothing that these characters are experiencing is anything that they couldn't have experienced.
Correct.
These are universal feelings.
Correct. And that's what makes a masterpiece, actually.
Yes.
And really valid point. I wish I had thought about that at the time. It's interesting that, you know, even though it's, you know, it was those years earlier, they were these people's ages in those years. So if you put the circumstance in the room, it's a total valid connection.
Well, and not only that, but the thing you were talking about, the finding in yourself something you didn't know existed. Mm. You know, the willingness to accept your whole self, even when what you're feeling violates what you were taught you should feel, that isn't special to, you know, somebody in 1943.
No.
You know, that's, hopefully, that's happening to all of us, that we're all willing to look at our whole self, not just the limited version we were told we should be.
Right.
I don't know, does that make any sense?
Makes total sense. And also, to be able to, in a healthy, productive way, confront. I mean, I think it'd be a lie to say that there's not a person who doesn't have some intolerances. And sometimes they come out of, what do they say, people in glass houses shouldn't throw stones. I mean, that there isn't a situation where you're frustrated or something comes up where it's like, you know, you thought, oh, I could have been more generous in that moment. You know, I could have, and you know, it's amazing. It's amazing, like, when you do. And there's, like, a total small example. I remember there was a time where, you know, I took my grandmother to the doctors. The nurse at the desk was so unkind, like, being very grumpy and kind of cranky. And I found myself getting a little, you know, my feathers ruffled. And I finally just said to her, I'm sorry you're having a bad day, but it's not our fault.
Mm-hmm.
It just like changed the world in that moment.
Mm-hmm.
And you could see her, she didn't realize she was treating us that way. And all I said was, I'm sorry that you're having a bad day. But she apologized, and we ended up like parting on such a positive note. And I thought, I could have handled that a different way. I could have said, you know, you're really being cruel, and I could have like gone at her.
Mm-hmm.
What a lesson that is. And that lesson has stayed with me, and I'm talking about 20, 30 years ago. 20,
yeah, it's your
ago.
Generosity that allowed her to be generous.
Right.
It's lovely.
And it's like, usually, you know, we all have our moments, and you try to retain those life lessons. I believe that people, this is what I said, people rise to their lowest expectation.
Well,
you know what I'm saying?
I do.
So it's like, so if I'm like as a director and I'm like frustrated, we're not getting somewhere, I can say, well, Lynn's only limited. Lynn's only going to get here, and I have to accept that, and you will only get there. But if I'm like, you know what? She can do this. She can get up here if I believe in her enough. And the actor will oftentimes surprise you, and they'll meet that. It's a really important thing to remember in life and in art. And sometimes we're frustrated with our own limitations. That is really about, oh my God, you know, when we get insecure as directors and stuff, you're like, oh, what am I doing? I don't really know what I'm doing, you know? And I've been doing this a long time. You get those moments of like, why can't I help them? And it's very easy to twist that to someone else's limitation. And I try to just say, no, I need to step up and do what I can in the time that I can. And it's all I can do. And I need to bring a positive faith into that person, into that moment, into that obstacle. And usually you'll get a lot farther that way. I think I'm a good audience. I have an innocence that I'm able to kind of bring when I walk in the door. And there are still pieces that take me away,
mm-hmm.
that I forget I'm in the theater, and I forget that there's light cues and costumes and all that. And I engage with the story. And when that happens, I know it's special.
Yeah. Yeah.
So we'll bring that kind of experience to the Oslo audiences.
Well, I want to say that it's clear that your commitment is to bringing that kind of experience to every audience that you present a piece to.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah.
And I hope that it will inspire your listeners to come and...
How could they not come? Knowing that you directed it. Okay, so I ask one other question.
Sure.
And it is, having given as much of your life as you have...
Oh, back to me, you like talking about
I
me.
Do, I like talking about you. To this work, to the theater, is there anything you would say about what that's like?
It's challenging, it's interesting. That, I mean, I'll say two things. One is I've tried hard, very hard, to keep having a life outside the theater. And it's very hard. And one of my mentors said, you have to have a life. Otherwise, you have no life to bring to the work.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, but still, it's a challenge to keep up with friendships and relationship. And I've had a number of relationships, but I'm single now. But it's like a vocation. It's like being a doctor or a priest.
Yes.
Or any of those things where, you know, my life is defined a lot by my work. And you know what? I'm okay with that. I feel very blessed. I'm lucky, and I really try to make sure that I have great life experiences. I don't get to go on as many vacations as most people. I don't have that. I've done it 5 o'clock, and I have my weekends. But Oscar Wilde said, I hope I quote this right, Oscar Wilde quote, to live is the greatest thing in the world. Most people exist. That is all. That, but I feel like there's a price on one side, but my life has been lived.
Yes.
And I don't have any regrets for that. And so, and there's a price for that. You know, there's a price for that. But I wouldn't trade my life. If I could go back, I make the same choices. So.
Okay. I could talk to you for the rest of the day, so, and I know you have to get back
to rehearsal. I have to get to rehearsal.
I know you have to go do your work. I know.
But I just want to end by saying that it's not often a director gets a chance to work on a piece this many times, this close together, and this production is in no way experientially or factually a remount. The opportunity to explore this South Pacific in this original way, which I hope will be intimate, both familiar but feel new, is such a privilege. And I so admire Michael and Linda and the Oslo for providing artists like myself opportunities like this. And I am excited about this show and as nervous and terrified about this show as I was the first time I encountered it.
Yeah, well, I want to say that we're grateful also to Michael and Linda for keep bringing you back.
Thank you. I hope I keep getting asked back. So.
Thank you.
Thanks, Lynn.
I interview people who make their living or their life with an art, because when you listen to them, you can hear what it sounds like to be who you really are. Because people who make their living or their life with an art do it because they can't help it. It is who they really are. And as you heard in Rob, it doesn't matter that he forgot that experience when he was 8 years old that might have told him that he was a born director. But when he had an experience later in life, he knew it. He knew this was who he was. He was home. He was with his people. He was with his family. And you hear at the end where he's saying that never mind that it's difficult. Never mind that you have to put together so much work that you don't get a chance to rest. Never mind that it makes relationships very difficult. He doesn't regret it, and he wouldn't do anything else because this is who he is. And so, as always, when I interview someone like Rob, I want to say thank you for demonstrating this so clearly, and to say to you all that it is my hope that as you listen to Rob, you are perhaps inspired to ask yourself, did you have an experience in your early childhood, something that really engaged you, really captured you, which you then forgot, moved away from, denied? Is there something waiting inside of you that would feel like home, that would be so powerful for you that you would be willing to endure discomfort in order to be it? Is there a piece of yourself which you've been cheated out of? If that is so, if you even have the suspicion that that is so, I hope you'll pursue it, if only just to wonder, if only just to be curious, And if you want to do more than wonder, more than be curious, I currently do all of my psychotherapy on the phone these days, and you can reach me at my website where you can find all this other stuff, thelinshow.com. You can click on email me. You can read the article I wrote about psychotherapy on the phone called Psychotherapy on the Go. And you can get me to come and speak to your group or organization. Well, as always, I hope that you heard something in this show that you can use, something that inspired you, something that made you laugh, something that triggered something important for you, even just something that you didn't know that you know now.
Something that will bring you back, because as always, I will be back next week, same time, same station, and as always, I sure hope you will be too. And now we're going to go out on There's Nothing Like a Dame from South Pacific.
We got sunlight on the sand, we got moonlight on the sea, we got mangoes and bananas you can pick right off a tree.
We got volleyball and ping pong and a lot of dandy games.
What ain't we got?
We ain't got dames.
We get packages from home.
We get movies, we get shows.
We get speeches from our skipper.
And advice from Tokyo Rose.
We get letters doused with perfume.
We get dizzy from the smell.
What don't we get?
You know damn well.
We have nothing to put on a clean white suit for.
What we need is what there ain't no substitute for.
There is nothing like a dame, nothing in the world. There is nothing you can name that is anything like a dame.
We feel restless, we feel blue,
we feel lonely and in brief.
We feel every kind of feeling but the feeling of relief.
We feel hungry as the wolf felt when he met Red Riding Hood.
What don't we feel?
We don't feel good.
Lots of things in life are beautiful, but brother, there is one particular thing that is nothing whatsoever in any way, shape, or form like any other.
There is nothing like a day, nothing in the world. There is nothing you can name that is. Nothing in the world
has a soft and wavy frame like the silhouette of a dame.
There is absolutely nothing like the frame.
Suppose a dame ain't bright, or completely free from flaws,
or as faithful as a bird dog,
or as kind as Santa Claus.
It's a waste of time to worry over things that they have not.
Be thankful for
the things they got. There is nothing you can name that is anything like a dame.
No books like a dame, and nothing looks like a dame. There are no drinks like a dame, and nothing thinks like a dame. Nothing acts like a dame, or attracts like a dame. There ain't a thing that's wrong with any man here that can't be cured by putting him near a girl.
I'm getting older, my hair is turning gray, oh, you say my face and figure have both seen better days. Well, sight. No, I will not go gentle into that good night. I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. Life's a song I keep on singing, not a tune that I once sang. I just keep returning like some goddamn boomerang. No, I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. You see that I have had my shot. My time has come and gone. Oh, won't I please get off the stage, let someone else get on. Well, I won't be relegated or leave without a fight. No, I will not go gentle into that good night. I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. Life's a bell I keep on ringing, not a chime that I once rang. You may think it's unseemly. Well, I don't give a dang. No, I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. Rising from the ashes every chance I get. I may be running out of time, but it ain't over yet. 'Cause me and Sister Phoenix, we won't give up the flight. No, no, we will not go gentle into that good night. And I won't go with a whimper. I'm going with a bang. Life's a song I keep on singing, not a tune that I once sang. I may not be as juicy, hell, but I still got some tang. So you won't hear me simper. I may have gotten limper, but I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang.
Bloody Mary is the girl I love. Bloody Mary is the girl I love. Bloody Mary is the girl I love. Now ain't that too damn bad? Her skin is tender as Tim Mitchell's glove. Her skin is tender as Tim Mitchell's glove. Her skin is tender as Tim Mitchell's glove. Now ain't that too damn bad? Bloody Mary's chewing beetle nuts. She is always chewing beetle nuts. Bloody Mary's chewing beetle nuts. And